I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President Obama said this week the U.S. was likely to continue airstrikes against the militant group known as the Islamic State, or ISIS, which has been seizing and controlling large swaths of territory inside Iraq. The president said Iraqi and Kurdish forces had retaken a strategically important dam near the city of Mosul, which he called a big step forward in dealing with the Islamic State. But the militants warned in an online video they would retaliate for those U.S. airstrikes, and their apparent retaliation has hit home in New Hampshire. News reports and state officials say journalist James Foley, who went missing in Syria in late 2012, was killed by ISIS fighters. Later in the show, we look at the social and political dynamics of a president's second term and how it affects an administration's response to issues like Iraq and the Islamic State. But for the first part of the program, we get an update on the killing of James Foley. And joining me with that update is Rick Stevens. He is Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press and has been reporting on Foley's life and his death. Rick, good morning.
Good morning, Brady.
Horrific news, but also a horrific way to learn the news. Describe how this all came out yesterday and how officials have been working to verify that it was indeed James Foley.
Sure. Late in the afternoon, around 4:30, maybe 5 o'clock, there was a posting of a video on YouTube and on social media that purported to show the execution of an American hostage. A very stark video. The hostage is seen kneeling in an arid location, no identifiable backdrops. Next to him is a man dressed in black with a black hood over his head, and he's speaking with an English accent, criticizing the U.S. foreign policy in northern Iraq, specifically the airstrikes that have helped Iraqi and Kurdish forces regained some of the control that they lost there. The video, which I have not watched, by the way, and won't, then purports to show the beheading of this hostage, who later is confirmed by U.S. officials as James Foley. James is the video journalist from Rochester, New Hampshire. His parents still live there. And they also later confirmed that it was their son who was depicted in this video.
And you had mentioned about the no identifiable backdrops, an arid location, the accent of the speaker in the video. And these are all things intelligence teams look at when they review videos by militants and insurgent groups to try and figure out when or where those videos might have been filmed.
Yes. It also, this gives us a sense of the increasing sophistication of their media unit. You know, it begins with what appears to be American footage of President Obama explaining his rationale for the airstrikes in northern Iraq. It has Arabic subtitles. And then when James Foley speaks, again, there are Arabic subtitles and English subtitles. So this video will be analyzed by all manner of the American intelligence and security apparatus. And we do have two. The Associated Press, Larry Jakes in Washington, has confirmed through two sources that it's a verifiable video of James Foley.
And we're told that President Obama is going to address this video and James Foley later today. It was over 600 days ago that he first went missing, November 2012, in Syria. Remind us again of what we know about what happened then.
Let's actually go back longer than that, Brady. He first went missing in Libya in 2011.
Right.
He was captured. Yeah. But this was a guy, he was a true journalist at heart. He once said that, you know, he'd cover the local zoning board if it meant doing journalism, because he loved the business and the job so much. He was captured in Libya, held for 6 weeks. He was released that time. So he knew what he was getting into when he went back to Syria. Or went to Syria, I should say. That was in late 2012. He was in a car on November 22nd in Syria when it was stopped by four militants in a battle zone that Sunni rebel fighters were battling the government forces of President Assad, his forces. So the car was stopped and Foley was kidnapped, had not been heard from or seen since until yesterday's video was posted.
There had been an investigation by Agence France-Presse, which had employed James Foley, and they had concluded that he was probably being held by the Assad regime, the Syrian government, somewhere near Damascus. We'll have to see what we learn going forward about where he had been and in whose hands at what times.
That is a huge question, Brady. And how did he go from one group to another, to this group, the Islamic State, if that is in fact what happened? And those are still questions that are unanswered.
James Foley's family, as you mentioned, lives in Rochester. The family put out a statement yesterday saying they have never been prouder of their son who gave his life to tell the stories of the Syrian people. What else have family members and those close to the family been doing?
Well, for 2 years, the Foley family has been a very strong advocate for their son's return, but not only his return, the return of other foreigners kidnapped and otherwise detained in battle zones in Syria and in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Yesterday at the house, Mrs. Foley, Diane Foley, was very gracious. She declined comment to the Associated Press when we approached her, but they later did put out the statement that you referenced. They have held consistent prayer vigils at the local church where they belong. They have worked with the diplomatic corps, both in the United States and the Syrian diplomats, to try and secure their son's return, and it was unsuccessful. We have not heard from the Foleys today, so we don't know what their next steps will be.
There was a statement. It was attributed to a member of the Foley family on Twitter, essentially urging everyone who came into contact with the video that purports to show his execution, his killing, that you should not share it, you should not watch it, you should not let it go out into the world. And Twitter has essentially responded with an attempt to black out these kinds of social media posts by the Islamic State, by ISIS.
That's right. Twitter and a lot of the other social media outlets are trying to block the spread of these images. Twitter CEO Dick Cassolo said his company is suspending accounts that they discover if they're related to this graphic imagery. At the same time, Twitter users, it's a little ironic, they're using social media to block ISIS media, but the hashtag is ISIS Media Blackout. So, they kind of get that name ISIS out there. ISIS is the Islamic State in Syria, although they've also since changed their name to ISIL. There's that outreach among social media companies. It looks like YouTube, the video was posted for some time on Tuesday before being removed. But like anything on the Internet, it's going to be very difficult to completely eradicate those images.
Journalists, especially those who knew James Foley, have also been urging people through social media channels and through traditional journalistic forms to remind people of the kinds of stories that James Foley was trying to tell as he traveled to places like Libya or Syria. And there have been quite a few interesting stories about what it was like to, say, be in captivity with him, that he was the kind of person who said, well, we have paper here in this cell, we have coffee, let's write, we can still tell a story.
That I think speaks to James's his love of the profession of journalism. There was another story that we were able to tell in 2011 after he came back from Libya, and this may give you a little insight into his mindset as well. He spoke to a reporter in Boston and spoke of the day that he was captured. He came under intense fire in Libya. He was with a colleague, a South African photographer named Anton Hamrell. Hamrell is injured. He's shot and wounded. And James Foley tries to pull his friend out of harm's way, but he's turned back by heavy fire. He's ultimately captured. But in this interview with the Associated, the 2011 interview, James Foley doesn't regret being captured, doesn't regret, the hardship that he's gone through. He says, I'll regret that day for the rest of my life. I'll regret what happened to Anton. I will constantly analyze that. He's thinking more of his friend than he is himself, and of the really important job of trying to bring those stories of of regular people caught in war.
And an increasingly difficult one. It's a dangerous job, even under relatively traditional combat circumstances. But when you start to bring in a situation as fluid and complicated as Iraq or Syria, it seems to amplify the dangers that much further, to a point that oftentimes news organizations say we simply don't feel comfortable sending someone into that much danger.
That's right. And a couple of factors there, Brady. You've got the Islamic State militant group, which is on the move in northern Iraq, headed towards Syria. This group is so ruthless. It started off as a splinter of al-Qaeda, but they are so ruthless and so harsh in their interpretation of strict Islamic law. Even al-Qaeda's leaders have disowned this group. So the notion of journalists being in harm's way in that region is certainly not overstated. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists said yesterday that they believe about 20 journalists are currently missing in Syria. They haven't released their names or nationalities. It's important to remember that James Foley was also believed to have been held with a journalist named Austin Tice. At the end of the video posted yesterday, the militant shows a second man who was identified as another American journalist, Stephen Sotloff. And, boy, talk about coming home again. Stephen Sotloff is a graduate of the Kimball Union Academy in Meriden, so another New Hampshire connection to this. And in this, at the end of this video, the militant warns that this other American journalist could be the next captive killed if the American policies in northern Iraq don't change.
Well, Rick, thanks so much for keeping us up to date on this very sad story. We appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me, Brady.
That's Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press, who's been reporting on the killing of James Foley. We'll continue to bring you the latest on Foley here on NHPR and NHPR.org. Coming up after a break, we'll take a look at the president's power and what he can and can't do as the end of his second term draws closer. You can join us with your comments and questions. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Be back after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Events on the ground in Ferguson, Missouri continue to unfold. Tune in to NHPR today for a special edition of the public radio program, The Takeaway, about the troubling situation there. We'll hear from residents and officials in Ferguson, from reporters, and you'll have a chance to offer your comments. Special coverage of events in Ferguson starts at noon today on NHPR and NHPR.org. Mostly sunny across New Hampshire for today. High temperatures in the upper 70s to lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Franklin Pierce University, a leader in adult education, offering RN to BS and RN to MSN in nursing leadership or nursing education degrees, franklinpierce.edu. And Golf and Ski Warehouse with stores in Hudson, Greenland, and West Lebanon, New Hampshire, and also in Scarborough, Maine, online at golfandskiwarehouse.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. It was Abraham Lincoln who said, "I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me." Many of Abraham Lincoln's successors would no doubt agree with that sentiment. Even in what's known as the most powerful office in the world, power has its limits. And while controlling events may sometimes be out of reach for a president, Americans still expect of those in the Oval Office what Harry Truman said of the job decades ago: the buck stops here. For the rest of this hour, we look at the forces that shape a presidency, especially in its second term: allies and opponents, both at home and abroad, media coverage, and of course, the president's own policies and style of leadership. And you can join us as well. How much should we expect of presidents, of their power to lead and shape the world? What other forces do you see playing a role? And how do you assess President Obama as he approaches the midpoint of his second term? The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email with a question or comment, exchange@nhpr.org, or join us on our Facebook page. With us for the hour, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of political science at Dartmouth College. His research includes misperceptions about politics, and he contributes to The Upshot at The New York Times. Great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Anita, in a way, it's almost a mark of respect for the office that we can even consider events to be the president's to control or lose control of.
That's right. I mean, President Obama said just last week, people always think that he can control everything. But obviously, particularly in his second term, so many things have come to fruition. Ferguson, Missouri, one of them, this week, that really has nothing to do with him. And he has to sort of cope with it, deal with it, and figure out how to move on from there.
Brendan,
not the second term he thought he would have.
You described it as, I believe, the myth of presidential control. How common is this perception that a president, especially this far into his term, loses control of events as it's described?
It seems to be very common. We have this notion, at least with the modern presidency, that the president is the most powerful man in the world, and it's very comforting to think of the president as being in control of events. That's something that people tend to want to believe in. And so we've created this mythology around the presidency that inevitably leads to this cycle of disappointment that President Obama is heading into now, when they can't control events to the extent that they anticipated. They can't take their agenda as far as their supporters hoped. And as a result, people start to bemoan their leadership or their failure to prevent whatever has happened in the world, which, of course, you know, the opportunities for things that the president can be blamed for are endless, right? Something like Ferguson, Syria, right? These are all things that no one anticipated, but of course, they land on the president's desk and people hold him responsible for them.
You describe it as the cycle of disappointment. Could you walk us through what that cycle might look like from a potential president, a candidate on the campaign trail, to a first term and then now about halfway through the second?
Sure. So when a new presidential candidate comes on the scene, there's often a great deal of hope in turning the page, this new leadership, new direction for the country. And Obama obviously crystallized that in a particularly profound way. This is someone whose campaign was built on the idea of hope. He himself represented change in American society by being the first African-American president. And so he arrived with this incredible surge of optimism about what he could do. And he was very successful in his first term, really his first 2 years, in passing some big legislation, most notably his healthcare plan. But presidents often do that, especially when they take office after the other party. There's an opportunity to pass some legislation when they first take office. And that, again, expectations are typically quite high. But then after that, it gets harder. That window of opportunity dissipates, where, you know, the issues that are left on the table are harder to deal with, and the public become, you know, the presidential honeymoon ends, the public becomes less approving of the president, and as time goes on, people start to get frustrated and say, why isn't the president doing more? Why isn't the president being more successful? Why won't he lead in this and that way that would somehow, and this is never specified precisely, that would somehow generate the outcomes we want, that would pass legislation or prevent these events in the world. And because presidents are held responsible for so much, the opportunities for that kind of second guessing are endless. And that's not to say that every decision Obama has made is perfect. Far from it. But we do go through this sort of a process with almost every presidency in the second term. Almost every president seems ineffectual. They can't pass as much legislation in their second term typically as they can in their first, for instance.
Nita, there was a book called Second Term Blues, and one of the authors said that presidents tend to present their big ideas in the first term. Here's what I want to do as president. I'm going to take the big items and put those on the table right away. And then the second term can be tougher to define, tougher to pin down.
I would agree with that. I mean, and President Obama really did make, obviously he had to deal with the economy in the first term that was not doing well. But he also wanted to pass health care, and he did get that passed. But it's important to remember that he had the Democrats-controlled Congress when he first got into office. And so as Republicans have taken over, at least the House, he's had a tough time. I mean, that's to be expected. Remember, his health care law passed with Democratic support but not Republican support. So that's why we're still fighting that, you know, five years later. So, I mean, while that's true, and he has probably less ambitious goals, I would say, this term, part of it is his problem is that he's always had sort of a problem with Congress, with lawmakers. I mean, he's even had a problem with Democratic lawmakers in getting along and getting them to vote for things that he wants and to embrace his proposals. So that's one of his biggest problems, and it's been there since day one.
And one of the issues, Brendan, that comes up too is that I think of the talk that came a year and a half ago or so as the president was beginning his second term, and he, like many presidents who are reelected, saw that as a vindication. Now, I've got a mandate for these policies, and yet you see not that long afterwards that things are bogged down.
That's right. That's right. Well, George W. Bush did the same thing. If you recall, in 2005, he was reelected and he turned to Social Security, private accounts in Social Security, thinking that that was going to be a continuation of his ability to move his agenda forward. He'd just been reelected by the country and it went nowhere. It absolutely failed miserably. So second-term presidents have a tough time. Without that political space that's opened up by a switch in party control of the presidency, you're pretty much stuck where you were before. He still faces those Republicans in the House, and Anita mentioned, and they can still block his agenda. Nothing changed really fundamentally between 2011, 2012 and the current Congress. And so he's more or less stuck in the same place. And, you know, he's, you know, largely a prisoner of events and what the Republicans in the House are willing to let through, which isn't that much.
What about what Anita was mentioning about the relationship between the Obama administration and Congress being described as anything from non-existent to frosty at best, even at a time when Democrats controlled the House and Senate at the beginning of his term? Has that been an example of not necessarily something that afflicts all presidents, but of something that the Obama administration particularly did not do well?
It's certainly one of the most common criticisms. I think it seems clear that their congressional relations could have been stronger. But the question that people should think about is what sort of a difference would it make? Ultimately, the Democrats will vote for Obama's agenda when it comes before them. And ultimately, Republicans generally won't. So whose minds will be changed? That's the hard part. You know, that we have this idea that backslapping is changing large numbers of votes. But even the most famous cases like LBJ don't really support that sort of a claim. You know, what fundamentally matters is the strength of your party in Congress. And, you know, there's no amount of backslapping that I can see that can change minds. And, you know, Brady, if I can just make one point, this gets to the fundamental issue in thinking about what we expect from presidents versus what they can accomplish, which is the formal powers of the president are quite weak. We expect so much from the president, but what tools do they really have? They have a lot of power in foreign policy, but as far as legislative relations, they have the veto, and that's about it, right? They're very limited in the leverage that they have over Congress, and that's reflected in the struggles that Obama has had.
And Anita, we've heard some of the president's frustration with those limitations, saying essentially that if Congress is not going to act, I'm going to take executive action wherever I can. And in some cases, there's been a lot of pushback over that, where Congress is saying, wait a minute, this is our job, not yours.
Right. I mean, you've seen the House of Representatives have said they voted that they are going to sue the president over his changes, well, mostly delays that he had in federal health care law. Ironically, it's the health care law they don't want, but they are going to sue him, or they say they're going to sue him, because he's delayed key pieces of that law. And the administration says they've delayed it because they needed more time and because businesses have asked him to do it. But there, he has called this 2014 his year of action, and that he is traveling around the country talking about executive actions that he can take. So that's executive orders and memorandum, different directives that he can do. And the reality is, we looked at them, the reality is this year anyway, a lot of them don't have much teeth. There are a few that were more aggressive or stronger, but a lot of them, I think he's touting about 40 of them, they don't have a lot of power because the president is limited in certain things that he can do. And so, he can do that all he wants, but it doesn't go as far as actual law, what Congress can do. And the other thing is, in 2 years when he leaves, the next president can just reverse what he's done. So there's not a lot of power there in those executive actions.
Today on The Exchange, we're looking at second-term presidencies. From Iraq to immigration, President Obama has come under criticism lately for what is described as ineffectual leadership, but from declining public approval to a propensity for congressional gridlock, second presidential terms have long been challenged by such perceptions. We're looking at President Obama's second term, the way our political system shapes and sometimes limits what he can and can't do, and how the media covers this office. And we invite you to join us as well at 1-800 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Brendan, we got an email a little while ago from Jack who writes, why should we even want the president to be in control of everything? Our Constitution was designed to prevent power from being concentrated in the hands of any one person or group of people. The late Senator Barry M. Goldwater stated it well. Freedom depends on effective restraints against the accumulation of power in a single authority.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. You know, one of the things I teach my students is about how different the contemporary presidency is. The president that we think of, the powerful leader of the free world, how different that is from both what the founders had in mind and the way the presidency worked well through the 19th century, right? With the exception of the powers that Abraham Lincoln took on during the Civil War, the presidency didn't look like this. The president didn't command a vast executive branch. The president didn't speak routinely to the public directly, didn't try to shape public opinion or lobby publicly for his legislation. So we've had this transformation of what we expect from the presidency, and that really is a different vision of how our government should work. And there are questions about the appropriate balance between Congress and the presidency. And that's a kind of political issue, of course, that we can work out through the system. But we shouldn't assume, for instance, that the president's inability to get their way reflects some sort of failure when, again, those sorts of constraints are built into the very system that they operate within.
Jack, thanks so much for that email. If you'd like to send an email, the address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also send comments and questions through the Exchange Facebook page or call us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Anita Kumar, Brendan had mentioned earlier on that theoretically, at least, the president has a freer hand when it comes to foreign policy rather than domestic. He doesn't necessarily always have to go to Congress to shape how the U.S. relates to other countries. But then you look at a situation like Iraq, and the president doesn't necessarily have a free hand in how he deals with the Islamic State or how he deals with the political instability in Iraq's government. So it's not simply just in foreign policy the president can say it and it will be so.
Right. I mean, it's definitely true. I would definitely agree with that. But, for example, in Iraq, he's got so many other issues going on. First, he has to deal with, you know, he has to deal with allies for sure, but he also has to deal with things that he said he would campaign, you know, campaigned on, things that he said he would do. I mean, Iraq is particularly problematic because that was one of his key campaign promises that he wanted to get the United States out. So that he's been haunted by, you know, his predecessor, George W. Bush, and doing the opposite or doing different things than him. I mean, he's got other constraints that aren't necessarily Congress. I'm not sure Congress necessarily wants to vote on this one, it goes way beyond that. And obviously, he can act as he has been doing these airstrikes, and we can still see what happened yesterday. Of course, you have to think that he has looked at those, you know, scenarios and thought of things that could happen and put that into his calculus. But yes, it's very complex, and there's many more problems on the foreign side.
And one of the difficulties as well, Brendan, is that there can be times when the president feels that it's necessary to take a resolute stand or at least sound that way. I think of the talk about the red line in Syria and the use of chemical weapons, and that appeared like a situation where there would be one kind of activity. If a chemical weapon is used, we will do X, we will make these decisions. And it wound up playing out very differently than the president had originally intended.
That's right. So even in foreign policy, where the president, like you said, has much more scope for taking unilateral action, the ability of a president to control events is still quite circumscribed. And, you know, we've unfortunately seen that play out in the post 9/11 era as the U.S. has struggled through its foreign policy to deal with all these different threats and concerns all around the world. Now, it turned out in Syria, of course, that that there's ultimately been an agreement to destroy the chemical weapons there that's been quite successful, that actually stopped being news because these other issues came to the forefront. So that's the other paradox of being the president is we focus attention on areas where things are going poorly. The chemical weapons destruction in Syria is the dog that hasn't barked, and so we're not talking about it. We are talking about the places where things aren't going well, like the rise of ISIS in Iraq and the civil war, continuing civil war in Syria, and so forth. Right. So when you're president, all these things pop up, and just as you deal with one, the next comes to the forefront. So take healthcare.gov. Right. The rollout was seen as a disaster. This defining moment for Obama's presidency, his signature initiative was going off the rails. They resolve the problems. The launch of the program has gone generally well. There are millions of people enrolled. They're still obviously working on it. But the focus has shifted away from that to these other issues precisely because it's gone better. It's no longer seen as a disaster. And so now we're focusing on these other areas where he's seen as not doing as well. So being president has this characteristic of it's seeming like you can't win. There's always something else that you're being blamed for.
And at the same time, Anita, then the president may have signature initiatives or proposals that he or she is willing to put forward or looking to try to get passed, and that can wind up getting thrown off track. I mean, the president has had a number of these tours where he will go out into the public, travel through several states, try to talk about, say, the economy or healthcare, and it will end up being overshadowed by something going on overseas or a big crisis like Ferguson.
Right. I mean, it's important to remember, you know, a year and a half ago or so, or when he was starting the second term, what he was talking about. I mean, this seems like a long time ago now, but he was talking about raising the minimum wage. We haven't heard a lot about that lately. He was talking about gun control, gun laws, because of recent shootings that had happened. He was talking about immigration, which we're still talking about, universal pre-K. So a lot of things he talked about at the beginning of the second term, the State of the Union address last year, we haven't really heard much about them. And those are the things he wanted to do, but there's just been a stream of one thing after another that he has had to deal with. Even if he wants to talk about minimum wage today, I don't think there's an appetite for that. So it's been quite hard for him. I mean, he's on vacation right now, and he's interrupted his vacation. I know it's always a working vacation, but he's addressed the media and the public a number of times from Martha's Vineyard on his vacation, things that he felt like he had to do.
We're talking about the second term of presidencies, including President Obama, on issues from Iraq to immigration and what a president can and can't do and why. We hope you'll join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or exchange at nhpr.org. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, who's at the bottom of the U.S. economy and what keeps them there? Then an update on the environmental effects of fracking. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather mostly sunny for today. High temperatures upper 70s to lower 80s. Mostly clear this evening, then becoming partly cloudy in the overnight. Lows tonight mid to upper 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Torrey Hill Author Series, presenting White Mountain writer and publisher Mike Dickerman on Saturday, August 23rd at 7 p.m. at Warner Town Hall. Details at warnerhistorical.org. And from Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a look at the future of automation and the workforce. You can join us with your thoughts by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange or on Facebook to continue the conversation there. This hour, we're looking at the presidential second term. From Iraq to immigration, critics have called President Obama's leadership ineffectual, but presidents have long been plagued by such perceptions in their second term. We're assessing what the president can and can't do and why. Joining us for the show is Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of political science at Dartmouth College. His research includes misperceptions about politics, and he contributes to The Upshot at the New York Times, and Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Brendan, just before the break, Anita mentioned that the president has been on working vacation and he's interrupted that vacation several times. But the idea of a presidential vacation is always fraught with peril, because if something should happen during that working vacation, the optics of the situation can work against the president.
That's right. It's politically sensitive to be seen as not working hard at a time when bad things are happening in the world. And you can see that this often affects these presidential vacations. You know, the same issue was raised about George W. Bush when he would go to the so-called Western White House in Crawford, Texas. But the reality is presidents are always working. They're always on call. They're always having briefings and meetings and so forth, even when they're ostensibly on vacation. So, you know, it's probably less of a meaningful distinction than it might seem, given that we live in a world where the president can be connected to meetings and advisors and so forth wherever he is. But it is a difficult situation because, of course, the presidency is an exhausting job. People always talk about how gray Obama's hair is becoming. And, you know, everyone – vacation's good for everyone. You know, it's an easy cheap shot for the media and the opposition.
Anita, I'm thinking it's something that even plays outside of just presidents. There were people I remember seeing on Twitter – as developments in Ferguson were unfolding, the violence, the tear gas and the protests. And there were people posting on Twitter about how Missouri's governor, Jay Nixon, still had on his schedule that he was headed to the Missouri State Fair and he wasn't headed to Ferguson. And then that quickly changed. So this is a situation where it's not necessarily that people don't want their leaders to have downtime. They just don't want them to have downtime at that moment where something is unfolding.
And there's always something unfolding, so it's kind of hard. Yes, the governor was criticized, and you'll note that he did cancel that event, and then he has traveled to Ferguson. But yeah, there's a lot of questions being raised about him, and similarly about Obama. I mean, but as we said before, it is hard to win on some of these issues. You speak about Ferguson, you didn't say the right thing. You don't speak, people want to hear you. I mean, it's very hard to strike the right tone for everyone. It's impossible, and so that has been difficult for him. But you are correct. I mean, he has been on vacation. He returned to Washington for a couple days. He went back yesterday. We have heard from him a number of times. We know that in addition to golfing and going to the beach, he's also doing a number of things. He was briefed on the video we talked about earlier with James Foley. So, you know, I definitely agree that the media and particularly Republicans or the opposition party in this case do criticize him for it. He just happens to be going on a vacation at a particularly sensitive time because of Iraq.
Let's bring in one of our callers now. Michael is calling from Concord. Hi, Michael. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you. I think it's really interesting to compare our system of government with a parliamentary system. And our system creates a president who is actually, as someone said earlier, quite weak. But is apparently quite strong. I mean, he effectively is perceived by many people as a monarch. His personality is examined at length and so on and so forth, and everything is blamed on him. Whereas, in fact, no president can succeed without a parliamentary a majority in Congress. And even our government depends on two parties in Congress who ostensibly disagree on important issues to cooperate to solve them, which, frankly, I find bizarre. Why should they? And it's interesting as well that virtually no country that's adopted a Republican or Democratic system of government has copied the American model. Most presidents in most countries are figureheads. And I wondered if someone could comment on that.
That's a great question. Brendan, the parliamentary system is much more straightforward. There's a majority. The majority does what it wants. But our system is designed to slow, at the very least, or possibly inhibit large-scale actions like you might find in a parliamentary system.
That's right. And a parliamentary system might be better adapted to the polarized politics that we now have. That is a challenge that we face, is that, you know, as the caller suggested, the way the system works, it's easy for the minority party to block action. So our system makes it much easier to block action relative to a parliamentary system. And so you have cases like government shutdowns that are much easier to create. And Mitch McConnell was just quoted today talking about how they, if the Republicans took back the Senate, they would be sending spending bills to President Obama with riders and essentially daring him to veto them that might prompt another government shutdown. So this is the kind of zero-sum dynamic you can get in a polarized political system that's very challenging for a president because they don't govern the same way a prime minister would in a parliamentary system.
And Anita, something that we've seen in several cases, but certainly has been the case with President Obama, is that there are times when he qualifies his statements or does not make them as high profile as he might, because that could change the dynamics in Congress. It might actually polarize an issue like we've seen in the immigration debate, where those who are opposed to President Obama might decide to back off on something that they might otherwise support if he comes out too heavily for it.
Right, and I think people on Capitol Hill would agree with that. Sometimes it's easier when he doesn't say what he wants. It's easier when he doesn't lobby and kind of lets things percolate on Capitol Hill. I mean, lately, though, that has not worked either. You know, separately from him, we've just seen a polarization in the most recent Congress that it seems to be getting a little bit worse each year. There have been times where Congress, members of different parties, have worked together and passed bills. I mean, as the caller said, that's the way it's supposed to work, or that it was designed to work. We just haven't seen that all that much lately. I mean, I believe this year we had said one of the most consequential bills that they did pass was a fix with some additional money for the Veterans Affairs after the scandal earlier this year about poor service. So they did manage to do something there, but on immigration and some other things they haven't. And President Obama is perfectly aware of that atmosphere right now, and he'll often say, I don't want to single a person out or a lawmaker out because I don't want them to, even members of his own party, he doesn't want to appear as if he's too close to them because it might hurt them. I mean, we're saying the same thing as the election comes up. Some of the Democrats don't want to be too close to him. And so he's going to refrain from going to their states or saying their names because it does make it more difficult.
Michael, thanks so much for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And speaking of the elections, the dynamics always change throughout the course of a presidential term. But as you approach that second midterm, Brendan, the role of the president continues to change and arguably starts to diminish because the president is in his final 2 years. People are starting to look to whoever the next person is going to be. And that consideration starts to play a bigger and bigger role in what people decide to advocate for and what people campaign on. And the president may end up fading somewhat into the background, at least a bit.
That's right. That's right. Those lame duck dynamics are powerful. I mean, one of the things you do have as a president is the ability to say, in the future, I'll reward you, I'll help you if you work with me. But of course, the time span that's left for you as president to do that starts shrinking very rapidly. The attention of the media and the two parties starts shifting to those 2016 candidates. And at this point in a presidency, you're typically a drag on your party, so they're not very interested in you anyway. You know, Democrats are running away from President Obama right now, just like Republicans were forced to run away from George W. Bush in 2006. You know, the 1998 midterm election that Bill Clinton did quite well in is an anomaly, and that's often attributed to the fact that there was a backlash against the impeachment that was going on at the time. But at this point in the president's usually not very popular. They're usually not able to help their party very much. And they don't have much to offer to people who are willing to cooperate with them. So they're, in essence, marking time. And that's a difficult place to be in, where you're simultaneously, again, thought to be able to control events, but you have even less levers than you did before, which wasn't that much in the first place.
Anita, presidents often defend themselves as they get to this point in their presidencies by saying, my policies were fine, my decisions were right, the implementation was okay. My problem was really explaining those policies, that it was the optics or it was the messaging. It wasn't necessarily the policy itself.
Well, that's probably true, although the White House, and this one in particular, I feel like over the years, so now in modern times, they've tried to control the message much more than they ever used to. The White House, the Obama administration, is doing a pretty good job of bypassing the media and trying to promote their own message. But I would agree with you on that. He does like to talk about how a lot of his policies, that if you ask most Americans, they would agree with him. And so why are Republicans opposing them when it's sort of a mainstream common sense idea? that is actually one of his big messages this year is, you know, people agree with me. These are common sense, practical things to get the economy moving or education or whatever he's talking about. But it's Republicans who are out of step. So he does often talk about that.
And Brendan, the media coverage, though, even if a president tries to bypass it, there still can be this narrative that there's a presidency adrift or there's a failure to lead or a difficulty in making those policies work. And that can shape what comes afterwards.
Sure, sure. You know, there's only so much you can do in bypassing the media. You know, your tools as president are fairly limited, and you know, it's hard at this point. I think the underlying issue here, Brady, that might help to kind of clarify this is part of the reason that presidents seem so ineffectual now is because of a mythology that, like we talked about earlier, that's created early in their presidencies when we tend to give them more credit than they're due for the successes that they have, to the extent that they have them. And those are often the result, for instance, of President Obama taking office with big Democratic majorities, right? So was Obama good at you know, pushing for his agenda? You know, sure. But a lot of that was just he was given a good opportunity to move legislation through. And so once that those structural conditions are gone, well, it's very tough. And that's what they're struggling with now. Now we often see this pattern you identified before, which is presidents saying, "Well, I just messed up the politics," right? So this is something Bill Clinton said about his healthcare plan. But in a lot of cases, these are more fundamental issues. The difficulty of being president and trying to advocate for something that provokes such intense opposition. That's a feature of the political context and system, not just if I use different words, something would result. I think that's too simplistic.
And something that you had mentioned earlier on as well is that the idea of opposition as an ongoing effort toward one particular president or one particular administration seems to have intensified over the last few presidencies rather than simply coming together on an issue and then differing on other issues. But there's sort of Lyndon Johnson, I think, was the one who said that if I walked on water, then people would write the president can't swim. That there's an effect that if the president goes left, then there will be a criticism of that. If the president goes right, there's a criticism of that as well.
That's right. That's right. So the party line voting in Congress is much more intense. And so the scope for you to win over votes from the other side, for instance, is greatly constrained. It's just very, very difficult. And as you talked about before, just taking an issue on a position can polarize it. So in a lot of cases, the president's best move is actually to get out of the way and create space for a broader conversation. Once the president becomes the face of an issue, it's very hard to get past those partisan dynamics. And that's why, for instance, the president, I think, has been so careful on the Ferguson case, for instance, to not take a strong view one way or the other. His public comments have been very balanced, where he's trying not to turn this into a Democrats versus Republicans sort of issue. And he tried a similar strategy for a long time on immigration. He eventually gave up, but he was trying to create space where Republicans could move forward, decide internally they wanted to move forward with some sort of immigration reform. But that ultimately wasn't in the cards.
And yet at the same time, Anita, presidents don't like to be put into these boxes and have these massive expectations about their power and their ability to move things through. But they also don't want to be seen as someone who is ineffective and can't get things through. So there's almost a paradox at work.
No, yeah, that's very true. I mean, that's why President Obama has launched this, you know, we can't wait. I can't wait for Congress to act and I'm going to have this year of action. I mean, he has been going around the country talking about the things that he can do because he wants to look like he can do something. And in some cases he is. It's just a question of how much can he do on certain issues. For example, a lot of the things that he's been touting are things that he's asking the private sector to do. So the White House would like businesses to do certain things when it comes to their employees or paying suppliers. Well, the reality is some of those companies, these big companies, were already doing things that he is advocating. And some of his lists, he's promoting those. But, you know, he can't force a private company to do anything. A lot of these things are suggestions or he's offering incentives to businesses to do things. It's just very limited in what he can do. Now, there are a few exceptions, and he has, ironically, it's before this, the year of action, that he actually had more substantial executive actions, but he wasn't talking about them. But this year, they've been quite modest. I mean, the one that we're going to wait and see that we're all sort of talking about here is immigration. He did try for a long time to leave Congress alone so that they could work on that. That has not happened. The Senate passed a bill. The House did not. We've got this added problem on the border with children coming across the border alone, and they didn't deal with that issue either. And so he has said at the end of the summer he's going to act unilaterally. And the question a lot of people are asking is how broad and how big and how aggressive can he be on that?
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Well, a big thank you to each of you for spending the time with us today and looking at these issues. Anita Kumar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Anita Kumar is White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And Brendan Nyhan, great to talk with you as well.
My pleasure.
Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of political science at Dartmouth College. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. And our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
The Exchange. It gets New Hampshire talking, whether it's schools or alternative fuels, the economy or astronomy, transportation, immigration, or what it means to be first in the nation. It's been said that the public interest is best served by the free exchange of ideas. I'm Laura Kanoi. Be part of our exchange, weekday mornings at 9, here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather mostly sunny for today. High temperatures upper 70s to lower 80s. Mostly clear this evening, then becoming partly cloudy in the overnight. Lows tonight, mid to upper 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Fuller Gardens in Northampton, inviting you to Reggae and Roses, an evening of fun, food, and music by Dread Rocks, Thursday, August 21st from 5 to 8 p.m. More at fullergardens.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Woven into the American fabric is the idea that anyone in this country can get ahead if they work hard enough. But research shows social mobility is much more fixed in the U.S. than in many other wealthy nations. Put simply, if you're born poor in America, you're likely to stay poor. There's little disagreement among economists that social mobility has remained flat for decades, but there is debate over what to do about it. Democrats tend to believe government policy could do a lot to help those on the bottom to move up. Traditional conservatives and Tea Party adherents have other ideas. Prospects for upward mobility in America. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Police in Ferguson, Missouri say last night's protests were less violent despite 47 arrests. They say there were fewer demonstrations, and police say they did not use tear gas for the first time in several nights. NPR's Kerry Johnson says Attorney General Eric Holder is traveling to Ferguson today. He'll hear from FBI agents investigating the fatal police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown.
The nation's first black attorney general says healing can't begin when looters and criminals are causing havoc in the community. Writing in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Eric Holder urges people to condemn the actions of a small minority of vandals. He wants to focus on a broader conversation about racial disparities in the justice system. Holder says he'll work with law enforcement and civic leaders to help foster trust between police and people in Ferguson. The investigation into the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown by a white police officer will take time, Holder says, and until then he's calling for calm. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Israel says more than 70 rockets have been launched from Gaza since a short-lived ceasefire with Hamas broke down on Tuesday. As NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Jerusalem, Israel says it responded to the rocket fire with at least 60 airstrikes on Gaza.
The cross-border attacks signal the suspension of attempts to try to negotiate a long-lasting